Hey, this is Woody from Bastille, and you're listening to the Stage Left Podcast.
Okay, welcome to the Stage Left Podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. This podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. So go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring members of Radiohead, Kraftwerk, Gorillaz, Bastille, Jungle, Queen, Earth, Wind & Fire, Guns N' Roses, Fleetwood Mac, Madness, Oasis, The Zootons and The Prodigy, who discuss their writing, recording and performing processes, as well as reflective interviews with musicians and producers who've worked in the studio and on stage with The Beatles, Beyoncé, Elvis, Pink Floyd and David Bowie. Today we are joined by the Ivor Novello and Grammy-winning songwriter and producer Fraser T. Smith. Ever heard of Set Fire to the Rain by Adele? Fraser co-wrote it. Remember Dave's song Black, possibly his finest moment to date? Fraser co-wrote it. Fraser is the most genuine, incredible man that I've ever met and had the pleasure of meeting. Working with this guy is beautiful. Not my words, but the words of Stormzy. So what a guest we have in store today. It's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left Podcast is none other than Fraser T. Smith. So 2 weeks ago, I was walking across Brooklyn Bridge going to a show from the 1975, and I bumped into someone called Denise Welsh, who was with her friend Kate, and we were talking about the show that was going to be taking place later that evening. And after speaking for about 5 or 10 minutes, I realised it was Kate Thornton, and she was telling me that you would be the absolute perfect guest for this podcast when she found out what it was about. What's even more surreal is that they kind of they wanted to do this Cagney and Lacey video, and they kind of pretended to arrest me and then uploaded it to bloody 500,000 people on Instagram. So it was quite a surreal day. But it was your name was the first person that Kate, when you've got to get Fraser on the podcast. Now, you once said, Fraser, that where art and commerce meet, there's a sweet spot. Now, for a young musician listening to this and getting to that sweet spot where art and commerce meet, what do you think should be their next step?
I think it's not an easy answer, but the balance between art and commerce, I think, is one that I've seen is one of the most challenging things. I think we're all artists at heart. I think commerce is in some ways a construct that we've been forced into, but ultimately is one that will enable us to reach an audience. And I think now more and more the power of reaching an audience is obviously in the artist's hands. So what I mean by the sweet spot is we can all sit in our bedrooms and or studios and make the most amazing music, but where is the audience? Where is the audience that provides the true connection? And within that, there is obviously a commercial side in that in order to reach an engaged audience, there's a sweet spot where we can make music that is palatable to people. I say en masse, I don't mean at the expense of your artistic vision, but I mean working out what is popular and what is going to be able for you to reach that audience and to engage. So I think through social media and through the music that you're putting out, it's finding that level of understanding, finding your tribe, working out what it is that they're into whilst not sacrificing your artistic vision and being able to bring an audience with you.
And would you say it's been your role in the past when you sit down to do kind of sessions with an artist to identify who their tribe is before they start writing? Or is it a case that's something for them to do and you write to whatever that tribe is that they think it is already?
I think the two things that you just mentioned are interlinked. I think I've always got one eye on where things can be commercial for the artist whilst also understanding what they want to say and how they want to express themselves. And I think that's what the role of a producer is, you know, by harnessing the vision, coming back to that word, you know, it's such an important word, the artist's vision. And I think that the best artists, the artists that you've mentioned already, Adele, Stormzy, Dave, have the most incredible vision. So it's then realizing that, but in a way that can be commercial to the extent where those artists are able to release album after album after album. And I think the best artists always understand their audience. Those three artists that we just mentioned definitely do.
And it's interesting because I was going to pick up on the vision thing, because it's something that you said before, that Stormzy's kind of, it's a word you've linked to Stormzy quite a lot. Is that a vision for the particular recording he's doing that day? Is it kind of a vision for the future utopia that his music might want to change the world to get towards? Is it a vision for his career? From your perspective, what level is he talking about a vision? Is it for that particular song? Is it short term, or is it kind of this really big kind of long term?
I think the best artists such as Stormzy have the vision in terms of the minutiae of the day and the minutiae of the track. Yet someone like Stormzy has this overarching vision. I mean, you can see from the other things, all the other things that he's done in his career so far. You know, we're talking about Murky FC at the minute, by all the things that he's doing to implement greater diversity within the Football League. The way that he's helped diversity at Cambridge University. You know, his vision is that really came together, where we all saw that incredible Glastonbury performance. That's a vision. And I think the vision of the video at the beginning of him talking to Jay-Z, but then ballerinas joining, but there being a cultural meaning behind ballerinas being on the stage, his shout outs to those who had come before him, his peers. That guy is so successful because he has this huge, huge vision, which you need to be a icon, I think. And that's that kind of vision puts you in the ranks of the greats, of the greats of rap, but I think with Stormzy, of the greats of culture.
And the music industry has obviously changed quite a lot, and therefore kind of perhaps the role of the producer has. Have you been in a position where you've kind of been sandwiched between what the artist wants and perhaps someone who from a record label or something like that has said, this is the type of record we want, and you're the kind of middle person between those two places? Is that something you've ever experienced? How would you advise someone to kind of navigate, again, that tightrope?
I think sometimes you do find yourself in those situations. I think that it's about being honest with yourself, being honest with the artist, being honest with the label. I mean, working with a particular artist at the minute, and I think an incredible singer-songwriter, I think that the label are coming from an artistic yet a primarily commercial place. I think sometimes it's translating the commerciality, which can be sometimes relayed to the artist from the label in a slightly heavy-handed way. I think as an artist that understands commerce, it's getting the idea, but then translating it in a way that does make sense. You can sometimes find yourself in a sometimes impossible situation where an artist who really should be independent and an artist that values the freedom that an independent label would give you is sometimes signed to a major, and maybe that deal's been run up by the manager or the deal's been run up by the lawyer, and you find yourself in a situation that is almost impossible because you the commercial vision of the label is so far away from the vision of the artist that it's then really hard because you're in the middle of a huge valley. And then at that point, I usually side with the artist and make art because it's way more fun.
And then, I mean, that's really great that you've kind of taken the brunt of that, because there's obviously a choice. You could go either way. Does that come back to bite you personally in any way, with that kind of relationship going kind of upwards hierarchically, sadly? Or does that actually give you, I mean, it sounds like you've got integrity, right? So it's kind of a nice way of doing it as well. So how does that impact other relationships as a result?
Do you mean the relationships within the labels?
Yeah.
I think you talk about integrity, and I think that's an important word. I mean, I would want to be remembered as someone who is very artist friendly, but that can get the most out of artists. The records that I'm most proud of are the records that have found the balance between art and commerce. I mean, you mentioned records like Black and records on the Stormzy record, on the Stormzy first album, but also Set Fire to the Rain. I feel like no one sold out there, but everyone got to where they wanted to be culturally, commercially, vocally, spiritually. And I think that those are the records that you really, personally, I really want to be involved in.
It's an amazing answer and great examples you give there as well. That's spot on. You once said that my studio is a very sacred space, an undisturbed quiet space where I try to get on a good level with an artist and be given opportunity to write and produce whole bodies of work and mean you can really go beneath the surface. So if a new artist is working with you, how do you personally go about getting beneath the surface with musicians without seeming kind of not intrusive, but how do you go about that to get beneath the surface? Because that's very clear that you've done that on a lot of the records you've worked on.
I think that everyone loves to get in the studio and start tinkering with the gear, and you know, that's the exciting thing. But I think the most important thing is getting on a level with the artist. And I think it's something I've always done. I find it hard to create with someone where you don't really know them. You know, I think in this day and age there could be a lot of people making records on laptops, and I think that the very fact that it's a laptop is a kind of barrier, because you have the screen sometimes between you and the artist. I think sometimes the role of a producer, not the role, but the physical setting of a producer, is that an artist can see the back of a producer's head a lot while they're making a beat. And I think that, and I've never really subscribed to that. To me, I grew up in bands, so when an artist comes into the room, I feel like we're the band together, and I'm the guitar player or the co-creator. I can be the tea maker, the therapist, the shoulder to cry on, or the person that goes and gets the food. I mean, I'm just there to really serve the artist whilst putting my ideas into the hat once I understand what it is that the artist wants. So I think a lot of these situations come about through conversation and through hanging out. A lot of artists have said, you know, what was amazing was like we talked for 3 or 4 hours and then the song came in an hour. And I was like, yeah, but that feels like way more gratifying because you got a song that you really wanted because you opened up to me, because I'm sitting here in a sort of non-judgmental state. Like, literally tell me about the music that you listened to when you were growing up. Tell me about, you know, what's your relationship like with your parents? Where do you live? How was school? All these different things. It just helps me. I can't write a great song with someone without knowing a little bit more about them, you know, and they might ask the same questions as me, and then you become friends, and sometimes it can happen really quickly, or sometimes they may take 3 or 4 hours, but I'm here for that.
And what's interesting you said about that is, because the reason I asked that is I think some of the records that you've done sounds like the person has worked with a producer who's kind of tapped into their vulnerabilities and made them kind of think, it sounds like, you know, what do you really want to say here? Okay, another says, what do you really want to say here? And it's really interesting that you use the T word. You said, like, sometimes I'm their therapist. And often that stuff can be quite time consuming, and that's great. But then some artists might be looking at the clock thinking, oh, I'm running up the studio bill here and that kind of thing. So it's a really interesting skill that you have to be able to extract that from people and kind of make them have that kind of safe space. And you're right, that song wouldn't have come in an hour. That's actually something you've extracted over a long period of time. That's so nice to hear that's your approach. I know when you worked with Arlo Park, you said, I think that you played a kind of a set of muted piano chords and a kind of relaxed beat, and then you asked her that big kind of essential question, so what matters most? Tell us about what happened then.
Well, that was slightly different because that was part of my 12 Questions album. So I realized that the dynamic had to change. So I posed the question, you know, I was a lot more in the driving seat because ultimately this was my record. So it was a slightly unfamiliar situation for me to be putting out my own record, obviously under the moniker of Future Utopia. So I realized that I had to come up at least to like 75% of having music to play, of coming up with a question and driving the concept, which was the question that you just mentioned, what matters most. And I think that we had an amazing conversation, and that was a really good example of a song which came very, very quickly. Stranger in the Night.
And, you know, I absolutely love that album. I love the concept of having these kind of 12 very, very thought-provoking questions.
Thank you.
That are, you know, were there. And so did you answer those collaboratively with some of those artists, or did you, you know, was it something that they were answering as well from their perspective, or was that just kind of your download from your own brain?
The download was the questions, and then I think I was there to steward the answers. So with Arlo, coming back to that session, I think at the beginning Arlo was a little bit overwhelmed by saying, look, I can't remember how old she was at the time, at like 20, 21. She said, look, to answer such a huge question, you know, I don't know if I'm capable of doing that. I said, look, the thing is with these questions is that they're not meant to necessarily be requiring philosophical answers. It's like, what matters most to you at the minute? What is the most important thing to you at the minute? That's what I'm asking. And she said, well, last night I split up with my girlfriend. I said, well, there we go. Let's talk about that. Let's get into the details of how you could see someone and you were so close to them, and then they literally become a stranger in the night. And that's how that song was born. So it was about, I would say, stewarding the answers, and really just in some cases like that with younger artists, holding their hand and just being supportive and allowing their greatness to flourish, which it certainly did across that
given
record.
Given that album is you flourishing though as just as much, and if not more.
Okay.
How would you have dealt with a situation where someone answered those kind of key essential questions with quite conflicting values or principles to your own, given that it's your own record?
Well, the thing is that I never came up with a concept of 12 questions in order to censor people. You know, that was not my job. This was asking these questions, and I mean, we followed on the questions because I felt they were so powerful. We did our own podcast. I asked people those questions at dinner. I'm just interested in the answers. So the people that I chose, those people were curated in a very, very thoughtful way. The people that I wanted on the record was my dream list. But ultimately, I'm neither agreeing nor being conflicted with the answers. Those answers are there for people to enjoy, you know. And I think it wasn't really about my values on my record. My record, the sonic values were mine, and the idea of these 12 questions, they were mine. And then it was like a playground. I would welcome people to be subversive and to be thought provoking within the answers. And I think that, you know, someone once said that the greatest questions are the thing which bring about change and bring about different thought processes. So I was here for that.
Now, there's one song on there called Children of the Internet, and Dave's on there, and there's this great quote in there about how, you know, there's a bit of research that says that for some of us, like, we touch our phones a million times a year.
Yeah.
Which finally touched upon the elephant in the room, that we are all addicted to our phones, like, or many, many people are addicted to our phones. And then you kind of talk about how we kind of made smartphones and the smartphones redesigned us. Big question for you, are you addicted to your phone?
I'd say not. Actually, I'm very, very aware of it. So I can feel it drawing me in. And I sometimes put it in another room. I sometimes give it to my assistant. That's one of the greatest luxuries, actually, to be able to just chat messages. The thing is that it draws you in on one level. So you may check your iMessage, and then you're going to check the WhatsApp. And then I think it's very easy for you to be, one, to be spending most of your day on the phone. And there's so many things that I want to do that are not phone related, such as increase my skills of playing guitar and piano and production and songwriting and write new tracks, that I just got to a point a few years ago where I was like, look, I'm slightly worried for all of us that we're going to look back and maybe feel that we've been besieged by information, yet we've been slightly lacking in action, which I think is what a friend of mine, we had a chat earlier where we were talking about the tyranny of choice, you know, which is an interesting one. You can go to your phone and you can do it. You can do, see, learn, interact with anyone, anything. But I think sometimes boundaries are good, especially for artists as well. You know, I think that boundaries in terms of time and boundaries in terms of certain other aspects in the creative process, but whether it's kind of keel or a tempo or I don't want that to sound uncreative, but I think sometimes relating that back to the phone, you know, whether we're sort of buried beneath the myriad of choice, I think it's healthy to put some boundaries within that. And going back to music, I think I was just looking at my computer now and just looking at within Ableton, which is the one of the doors that I use to come up with ideas. But, you know, talking about the tyranny of choice, you know, I can get any drum sound here. I can call up any string sound. I think it's healthy sometimes just to jump off this. And for me, jump onto a drum machine and with two synths plumbed into it, you know, and just actually make something really cool with less.
What was your first ever job, and what did you learn from it that you perhaps still use in some way today?
I think that the sign of any good musician is the amount of shit jobs that they've had. So I was just trying to think of the first one, but I mean, there was so many. So from, I guess, like an early paper round, but through to strawberry picking, through to working as a cleaner in a sports center. Do you mean in a sort of philosophical way or a...
Yeah, I mean, often I speak to people who are young musicians now who are doing a type, any job, and they're kind of in this this like crossroads really in their careers. Like, do I stop? Do I carry on? Et cetera, et cetera. But often if you speak to a lot of people who are kind of experienced, they go, actually, looking back at the time, I hated that, but actually I got quite a lot from that. I kind of learned or I developed in some way that was actually kind of, stood me in good stead later on. Or do you see that those jobs were just a means to an end back then and they don't really relate to where you are now?
No, not at all. I mean, I think the thing is with those kind of jobs at the very beginning, which actually carried on, I mean, I'm not ashamed to say, but I carried on like well into my 20s, you know, where I was washing up. And that's not a sob story. It's just the reality of making it as a musician in the years that I was coming up was just, you know, you had to get the balance of more and more gigs. But when the gigs were dry for me as a guitar player, which they were at the beginning, because how can they be, you know, you come out into the world being able to play guitar, and then you just have to work out where your place is in the scheme of things. But I think that what I would say, those jobs are grueling, you know, and those jobs give you an empathy with people working and with how life is. And they're also, you develop grit because you go, look, I could do this job, which is challenging enough, but I know that I'm going to have to get home at 12 o'clock and do like a couple of hours practice or write a song when I get back or fit this in to which is already a full-time job. And I think sometimes I see it with young artists, going back to what you were saying, you know, where you come to a crossroads, and I sometimes see like artists, you know, in inverted commas, turn professional, you know, which basically means like giving up your job and doing things full-time. And I sometimes feel artists can sort of lose their bite a little bit, because I think you really develop that grit and it tests you. And I think that it's a really good grounding for them becoming a bona fide artist, where most artists that are successful are having to record at crazy times and then get on a plane. And, you know, it's quite an athletic type of job being a musician. You know, you may do a show and then you come back and then you got to talk to, so, you know, jump on an interview, and then you're off to the studio, and then you know it's bang bang bang. And I think that sometimes you can have too much time on your hands, you know. So I think from my side, definitely a sense of grit, you know, where you're doing those hard jobs, and a sense of empathy, you know, where when you've washed up and when you've served pizzas to millions of different people over the years, you know that when times are good and you're actually the person that is being served the pizza, you make sure that you look that person in the eye, because you know how it feels sometimes to be not only working a really hard job, touching those burning plates, trying to carry like eight pizzas on your arms, but also when the people at the table are maybe looking at you like a piece of shit, you know, you go like, come on, like, let's make sure we tip this guy properly or this girl, and you know, there's a real sense of humility behind that.
It's part of your DNA, right? So you're an Ivor Novello winning songwriter and Grammys and all that kind of stuff, but that's, you know, that's as part of, as much of you as it is, you know, writing songs with Adele. And I think that's really important to kind of highlight for young musicians listening to this.
100%.
And you also once said, I'm confident about what I can do musically because I'm lucky enough to have been in loads of challenging situations musically. Can you, if you're happy to, can you share one or two of those where you felt most kind of out of your depth or most challenged earlier in your career, and how you kind of got through it and what advice you'd give to someone in a similar situation?
Rick Wakeman was a good one. So Rick Wakeman, for anyone that doesn't know, was one of the most amazing session players in the scene in, I guess, the early 70s. So he played on David Bowie's Hunky Dory album. He played Morning Is Broken, Cat Stevens. He was in the Straub. So the most amazingly accomplished musician. Then went on to form a band called Yes, who were one of the pioneers of progressive rock music. So that music is up there with any music I think you could ever play. And then was a hugely successful, still is a hugely successful solo artist. So had the Six Wives of Henry VIII. He had a number of incredibly successful global records, which he released. And he asked me to be, early on in my career, his guitar player. So learning a lot of the music that he had come up with, purely instrumental music, Journey to the Center of the Earth, for example, is like a 60-minute piece that never repeats, that is in odd time signatures, which there's nothing to come back to. There's no necessarily a chorus. It just keeps going. It's a journey. You may have a bar of 7/8 followed by a bar of 3/4 followed by a bar of 11/8. You know, I mean, it's literally the biggest kind of roast as a musician that you could ever do. So I learned a lot about odd time signatures and musicality and chords and rhythm, and really tested like my memory. But it really helped me, and I don't think that having worked with Rick for such a long period of time, both live and in the studio, I think I was really well equipped to deal with all sorts of technical challenges. You know, I felt like I can play this music. It really gave me the confidence. You know, it was like going to do some SAS training and then someone going, oh, do you come and do like a personal training session with me. You'd be like, yeah, I can. I've been out in Jordan with the SAS troops. Like, I know what it's like to carry like a burqa up these hills, like in the boiling heat. Like, I can definitely come and do that. So I felt that really gave me such a good grounding, and also helped my musicality in terms of being able to feel some of these odd time signatures, because there was no way you could count it. It wasn't a question of like, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, you know, it was too fast. So you had to learn these quite complicated phrases and approach it musically, so playing across the bar lines rather than counting and being very like bar by bar, because this stuff was coming so quickly, there was no way you'd be able to do that anyway. So it was just like the most amazing grounding that I was blessed with, and to be able to talk to Rick about spending time with David Bowie as he did, and his orchestration and piano playing across those records, and just learning from someone that is a true great at such a young sort of tender age of my career just set me up for the kind of stuff that I do now. It was amazing. Ever thankful to Rick.
Like the greatest apprenticeship ever, basically.
Greatest apprenticeship.
Like, yeah, Rick Wakeman is like the musician's musician, basically. It's a really, really nice story, that. You said about, just to analyse something you said there about the memory, so you said like you're kind of dependent on your memory being really, really effective, given some of those types of music you're talking about. Like, what was your technique in that situation to, you know, learn a 60-minute piece of music with all those some time signatures and stuff like that? Did you make notes in front of you? Like, you know, with some approaches that, how did you go about? Was it learning 10-minute segments? How did you go about that?
Yeah, I'd break it down into segments. And I mean, I find it challenging to read music and to read notes. I find that once the side of my brain, as soon as I'm reading music or I'm reading notes, it's never committed to memory. So I had to learn it as a piece and just learn the structures and the by, as you said, by breaking it down into 5, 10, then putting that together, breaking down each song and then putting them all together. And actually, having worked with Serge on The Alchemist's Euphoria, the latest Kasabian record, I was actually asked by Serge to join the band. I hadn't done it for a while, and that was actually another amazing experience to go back and actually learn. I hadn't learnt an hour and 20 minutes worth of music since probably many, many years ago. Because, I mean, when you're working in the studio, you're really dealing with 8-bar loops, aren't you? You're dealing with small sections, you cut and paste, and then you're not really learning how to play the music, you know. So to have done that, kind of, you know, dusted off that little place where is reserved for learning long sections of music. You know, the Kasabian stuff, interestingly, is, I think when you see it from afar, you know, as I did, I was like, wow, these songs are so powerful and incredible. And you know, you see the live shows and how amazing the band are and how incredible the crowd's response is to it. And when you actually dig into that music, it's very, very deep in terms of where it goes musically. It's very rare that you chug along on one chord. You know, it's Serge is such an incredible artist and a musician that he's always putting like new little sections within a song, which is inherently like a huge chorus, but then in the verses it'll switch and it will go somewhere that you wouldn't expect.
Hi there, this is John Woff, the saxophonist with the 1975, and my favourite episode of the Stage Left podcast has to be episode 49 with Bob Rounds. His anecdotes of working as a sideman alongside John Mayer are absolutely fascinating. Go and take a listen.
Piece of music that you co-wrote, which is an absolute work of art, took that Black by Dave, and it's one of the most important pieces of music I think that's been written in the last kind of 10 years or so. I wonder if you could, if you're happy to, just talk through your memories of that day, writing that song, co-writing that song, and its finalised version, and you know, and then eventually the Brit Award performance, which was astounding.
Mm. I think Dave's relationship, my relationship with Dave, comes from a place of jamming and musicality. So we always jam the music first. So we had the piano idea. I came up with the drums and had some ideas of what Dave was going to write, because he put a few rough ideas down in the studio, and then he went away as he usually does and wrote the masterpiece, which is Black. And then once he'd recorded it, I thought it was important to come back and tweak some of the piano and the strings to bring out some of the emotion on certain lines. So that was the process. And then the Brits performance was something that was an absolutely unforgettable moment of I remember when Dave asked me to be there and play piano on that track, and no one was really, well, I certainly wasn't sure what was going to happen in that last verse. And we'd rehearsed so hard to make it sound as perfect as it could, you know, because when you literally, it was just the two of us with the wonderful string section. Yeah, Rosie Danvers and the brilliant string players. And I was so focused on being there, really being like the steady ship for Dave, because I knew he had a lot to do. I knew he was obviously looking at the performance. He was looking at his new verse that he was putting at the end. He was looking at playing the piano at the same time. I realized he had a lot on his plate. So I just needed to be the absolute rock there for him. And I knew obviously the subject matter is hugely emotional. Being at the Brits, it's been broadcast out. It's just so much going on that I was just determined. So literally, me and him would be practicing at double time, like with a metronome. We were just so on top of what was going on. And I just remember the feeling I can only describe when Dave came into that last verse, and it still gives me goosebumps to think about it, but when he started rapping that and people could hear what he was saying, I just felt this wave of electricity come from the audience up onto the stage, and it literally, it felt like it was like lighting. So you could just feel it being directed at Dave, and obviously being on the stage there with him, I felt it too. And it was one of the most emotional feelings musically that I've ever had. And to feel the reaction, which you feel strongly after having performed it, because you're so in the moment at the time you're performing it and you're on in ears, but then watching it back and just seeing the effect, and I just felt very privileged to be on that stage with Dave that evening, and it's one of my most poignant memories within music.
It could be your legacy or part of your legacy. I mean, it is just such an important performance in so many ways. And I remember tweeting the moment it went out that this is like, you know, when Michael Jackson did the Moonwalk for the first time, you know, at the Motown show. For me, it was just such an important performance. On Saturday, I was on a tube to go to a show at Shepherd's Bush Empire, and the central line broke down. And so I had to get a cab so I wouldn't miss the show. I went past Grenfell Tower, and it's that moment I thought, wow, yeah, because Dave did a kind of piece at the end where it was obviously... Maybe, well, obviously it wasn't improvised, but I wondered, so what he covered for listeners' benefit, he covered Grenfell in that moment. He called out Boris Johnson as a being racist. He talks about Jack Merritt, which was an amazing piece as well, and the imagery Jack Merritt came up about, someone who was kind of running prisoner reparation programs and was sadly killed by terrorists who he was trying to kind of support. And the piece by Dave about it is just so beautiful. I wondered how shrouded those last few verses were. Obviously you didn't know what was going to happen, and after he did the performance, was there any kind of like issues with the producers of the show or anything like that? Because I bet if he'd done that in the rehearsals, there would have been a mute button.
Yeah, that's the thing. And it actually took me back to Stormzy's performance in 2018, yeah, which was again shrouded a little bit, and then, you know, both Dave and Stormzy stepped up and really performed and spoke their truths to the public, and I think both of them were able to shift culture at those moments, and to be part of what they were doing at that time is, as I said, such a privilege. And you know, what you say about earlier, we were talking about where art and commerce meets. I think where art, commerce, and culture meet, then that is the real sweet spot. Because you have the ability to change. You're working on music, which is touching people emotionally, but within the music. You know, what Dave and Stormzy were saying on both separate occasions, but both at the Brits, were what really the society wanted to hear and society deserved to hear. So having young icons like Stormzy and Dave actually saying it and using their platform for the greater good is, I think, the most incredible thing to do.
Kind of an example of that, it's only a small example, but I teach away from here. Obviously the music industry doesn't always pay out, so you have to have loads of different jobs, but I teach a master's where we focus on what a good leader does in 2022 as recording is going into 2023 compared to other eras, and we talk about the topic of privilege. And for some people who are in leadership positions, they don't get it, they don't get the point of privilege. So often I send them that performance that you do to highlight, right, okay, do you get it now? Like, this is such an important thing that we need to be considering. And it's the fact that that's kind of filtered into the stuff that I do just kind of is highlighting how it's getting on, you know, it can reach into lots of different places that a performance of another song might not have done. I think it's just such a important performance. So like, just kudos for being involved in it. With the piano, I'm just interested because there was some incredible imagery. Could you see that from where you were sat?
No.
Or was that all kind of...
No.
I didn't think so.
No. Okay. Yeah, it was a guy called Bronski that does all the visuals for Dave, who's an incredible guy. And that, actually watching that back as everyone else had seen it, you know, sometimes the irony of doing performances in that you don't quite get to see how it is when you're in the audience. So I mean, you're incredible. I'm incredibly grateful to have been on the stage, and then when I saw it back I think I watched it on YouTube. And I was like, wow, those visuals are very, very powerful.
Absolutely. It's a very, very important performance. How do you feel when you work with someone and they start working with someone else, right? So you might have co-written an absolutely humongous hit single and then they go and work with a different producer and they kind of don't get you back in, that kind of thing. That must be an odd thing. You know, I was looking through your career and I won't name names or anything like that, but I thought I'd feel really odd about that if I co-wrote a massive, massive hit single and wasn't asked back or the opportunity didn't come up again. What happens at like award ceremonies? Is it just like, oh, hi, yep, co-wrote that amazing song for you. Nice to see you soon. Like that must be a very odd thing that sometimes the relationship doesn't continue forward.
Yeah, I think, I'm not going to say it isn't weird. I think that, but I think just from a point of view of doing bodies of work with people, you spend so much time. And then I think life for everyone is really busy. So then you see artists go in a slightly different direction or work with other people. So it's not my ego which is dented at all, because I'm like, look, there's so many great people for an artist to work with at any point. And I think that the same will probably be similar with actors and directors and producers. And it's just the way, isn't it? That not everyone is going to have a George Martin, Beatles kind of relationship. So I feel absolutely, you know, at peace with the fact that artists work with different producers. But it's, I guess it's just a level that you, in some ways, you miss the connection. Because, say, for example, let's say Stormzy is a really good example. Stormzy and I spent 10 months together, up to a year maybe, working together, so close, texting every single day. Then Stormzy wanted me to work on Heavy as a Head, but I couldn't because I was working on my record. Now he's just released his third album, which is incredible. Progression has is an incredible producer and executive producer has executive produced that record. I saw Stormzy at his show at the O2, but obviously we had, you know, a great time seeing each other, but it was a very short amount of time, and I'm not involved in any of the creative of this latest record. And, you know, I have nothing but love for Stormzy and love for Progression and for everyone on that record. But yeah, it does feel like you're just interested. I can't wait to hear the record, and I'm excited to hear great things about it, and I just want him to do really, really well. But I think creatively, yeah, there's a level that you're like, oh, I just miss that guy. I love being in the studio with him. It's like you feel slightly bereft at times, because you just think, and I don't mean on a commercial level, like, oh, I want to write another hit, like, you know, Blinded by Your Grace with Stormzy, but you're just like, there were so many jokes in the studio and being in the studio with Flips and Rhymes and like just coming in and just having jokes and creating, you know, it's a very special connection. Like there's, I could probably count on one hand the people that I would say I come back to time and time again when I think about my greatest creative partnerships. You know, there's a lot of people I've worked with, but you kind of would go, on one hand, it's this person, it's this person, this person, where you'd be like, this is, and look, you've mentioned a lot of them already, but, you know, adding a few more into the pot, you know, adding someone like Kano 100% into that mix of where you go, look, there's just real magic in the studio here, and there's magic across either an album or multiple albums when it comes to Kano, you know, and you go, I'm creatively restless, so of course you want to create with people, because I love creating. You know, I'm not satisfied. You know, I want to do more. I want to create greatness. So obviously you're going to look to the people that you've had great times with, where you've made great music. So yeah, in answer to your question, it can be challenging, but you know, you also can't do everything. And I think, you know, I had to go and do my 12 Questions record and develop as an artist as well as a producer, and that was such a gift to me, that whole process. And I had to make a very, very difficult decision to say to Stormzy in this very room, you know how much I love you, you know how much I rate you as an artist, but I'm still not going to be able to do this because I have to follow my own path at this point. And he completely understood. So
now he said once that about your beautiful partnership, to quote him, and you kind of allow him to realise the artist he could truly be. What about working with him? How has he kind of enabled you to be the producer that you maybe never knew that you could be? How has he kind of enhanced your development and ability and capability as a producer?
There's the stories is that he, when we were working on Gangstars and Prayer, you know, there was lots of pressure on him, I think, to really deliver because, you know, he was, through the tracks he released, at a point where it was like, okay, you need to come with this great record. So he's such an interesting artist because he has such a great, huge vision, but he also comes with slightly abstract influences, which I love. You know, he'll be talking about saxophone in the episode of The Simpsons or bringing up, you know, some slightly niche French artist that we can draw from. But he's so encouraging in the studio, and so much fun and so talented. He has so much attention to detail. And if you have an idea, he'll run with it. He introduced me to some incredible music and pushed me to come up with, you know, a gospel track in terms of Blinded by Your Grace. He understood that I could bring something to the table on Big Few Boots by putting like a vocal sample into that, and to work with him and Sospiro on the track that they'd done. He's so inspirational, you know, and getting to know him as an amazing guy was just, again, a great privilege that I'm grateful for. And, you know, to have someone, it's a really good point that you raise, because, you know, the greatest artists really do push you. And it's been the same with Adele and all the great artists I've worked with, Kano, Dave, you know, they push you out of your comfort zone. And so you grow exponentially as they do. So every record is a blessing.
Now, when you went to do the future Utopia project, and therefore you're producing your own stuff, how did you feel about getting to the point where you go, okay, this is done? So I know loads of musicians who do their own stuff and it just ends up being, okay, take 186 or mix 186. When will my life forever? When will I get over this? Yeah, when I feel, you know, and it just goes on and on and on. And it's definitely something I've had such a problem with in the past. If you're not handing that over and that decision-making responsibility over to a producer, how do you kind of, is it a deadline you give yourself? Like, at what point do you go, I'm not touching this again?
We say mixes, like some of the mixes, because the arrangements were very dense, or are very dense, on 12 Questions. So, yeah, I was lucky enough to have strings and brass and live drums and program drums. So for me, like the mix in this, and it was the first thing I'd ever done in my studio out in the country. So I was getting used to the sound of the room. I decided to plumb in all the outboard. So I had like 32 channels of outboard going. So every single track, like, was huge kind of recall situation. And that was my kind of lockdown indulgence, if you like. You know, I was afforded that time to mix. I think after having been making music for so long, I've kind of got an inbuilt kind of alarm that goes off when things are maybe getting a bit too indulgent, or the mix is not benefiting. And I would always, as I'm sure we all do, you know, you label your mixes sequentially, so you can always go back and you can just go, look, let's just check, like, mix 4, if I'm on mix 20, like, are we moving forward or are we not? You know, what was good about that? So I think the thing about being a producer is you have to maintain objectivity, because you have to be able to zoom into the minutiae and zoom out. You know, like I was saying with Stormzy, he's got such attention to the detail, but also an eye on the bigger picture. So I think similarly, as a producer, you have to, even with yourself, you have to zoom out to know if you're moving forward or not.
But that's subjective. Like, that must be so difficult to kind of, if you're doing it yourself, and you know, and that, I think a lot of, I mean, I know musicians, I'm not going to name them, that have taken 15 years to put a record out, and it's literally because of this stuff, because every time they listen back to it, fresh ears, something's got to be changed here. I've got to go back and tweak it. And I think it's such a difficult thing to navigate. So just kudos for actually getting it done, because you're not in the trap of the wheel of going round and round, which can definitely happen. What's one song you wish you could go back and re-record as the finished product didn't turn out as you hoped?
The finished product didn't turn out as I hoped. I mean, I'm pleased, you know, pleased to say that there's nothing that would change. And again, I don't mean to sound conceited or big-headed when I say that, but I do remember early on, like, one of the first people I ever worked with in the studio on a commercial release was Craig David. And he told me very early on, he's a very, very wise soul, Craig, you know, and he said, look, I was talking to him about the amount of vocal takes he was doing one day, and he said, look, I have to know that this sounds great, because this comes on the radio and there's one thing on there where I'm just not happy. And that just stayed with me, you know, where I just thought, I'm going to go the extra mile on each track, because if this becomes like your defining record that people always remember, but you're thinking, ah, but the piano doesn't sound great on this, or the drums aren't right, or whatever. So I've been strong never to be kind of rushed by people. In terms of finishing, there've been some close calls where Tyler Cruz on Break Your Heart had put down an incredible vocal and he didn't feel it was right for him, so he wanted to give that track away to a female artist who, I won't mention who that was, but would not have done that track justice. And the way that Tyler comes on that track rhythmically and melodically is, to me, was just incredible. So there's been times where, you know, I've had to be strong and just gone, look, you need to put this out, like, this is your song. So but you know, you're passionate about music, so why would you not do that? Why would you not make things sound great? I mean, I don't know, like, interesting though, because I watched the Get Back documentary, as I'm sure, have you seen?
Yeah, I loved it, yeah.
The thing that I was really surprised about, seeing how strong Paul McCartney was in the studio, was how he let The Long and Winding Road go out of the studio to be produced by Phil Spector, who was obviously a legend, but he didn't like the bells and
then
whistles.
He was a legend.
Well, yeah, then he was a legend. But he got that track produced by Phil Spector, who did the Phil Spector thing, put loads of strings, wall of sound, bells and whistles, got it back and didn't like it, and had to live with that until the point, I think it was quite recently, wasn't it, where he did the
strip naked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I found that really interesting. I'd love to ask him about that one day.
It's giving away, you know, it's giving away the baby, isn't it? It's that kind of thing. It's such a difficult thing to do. But, you know, the songwriter's written this piece of music, hand it over to the producer. Sometimes you've got to be a bit detached from it, I guess, to you know, and just trust that other person. This touches upon a very, very important topic, and I'm going to bring in our emerging artist in a moment. However, before we do that, how do the conversations start and end when you're in the studio around credits? Right, so you're kind of co-writing. At what point does the co-writing begin in the production? My role actually was just a producer on this, and maybe this is a co-write here, given the ideas that we've jammed out. How do we navigate those conversations without it causing that tension and awkwardness in the very space that you don't want that to happen, which is your safe space of a studio? So how would you advise someone who is working with someone for the first time, a producer, and they say, maybe this is, you know, it's a credit, maybe if it's not, how does that all work?
I think you can establish ground rules, really, in terms of, for me, if you're creating something from the very beginning, three people in the room, that's 33 1/3%. You know, if you're coming up with something from scratch, you're all coming up with musical ideas and all pitching in. So I guess but I think the most important thing is to have correct representation and to always be fair. Sometimes you're going to have to take a little knock, but I think that it all evens out in the end. And I think this, sometimes you can get you can get stuck with some of those credit things. And personally, I mean, I'm not saying everyone has to work in the way they feel comfortable, but for me, I feel comfortable making music. And if anyone, the people that I'm working with have integrity. And if anyone shows a lack of integrity, I wouldn't want to work with them anyway. I'd be happy for the song not to come out. And I think that anyone with a soul, which is 99.9% of people within music, will know what is fair, will know what a contribution is. And I'm more than happy I'd much prefer for people to feel like they owe me than for people to be feeling like I made them be on the back foot. You know, the way I look at it is that I'm going to be writing, I write so many songs and, you know, work with so many people that it's all going to balance out in the end. You know, I don't tend to get hung up on it. You know, sometimes people want to be like, if it's 33, oh, well, I deserve like 35, 36. And for me, that's a little bit like the person that says at the end of a dinner where you've all had a good time, but I didn't have a starter, or I didn't have a dessert. You know, it's just like, you know what? If you feel like you want the extra 2%, like you feel what you put in was more, it's cool. But, you know, music is a delicate thing that really, when it comes down to splits, if you're going to work with someone over the long term, you'll take a knock sometimes, they may take a little knock. It balances out.
And you said that at the beginning about like you want to have some ground rules, but it's interesting how many people would buy into those ground rules. So like that seems very reasonable. You said, okay, 33.3 and just split it, that kind of, you know, and it'd be interesting to see what percentage of the music industry would go, oh yeah, I agree with that, if someone's contribution might be more significant and they write a particular hook or anything like that. Yeah, such a fascinating world. Do you actually have those conversations? So when do you have the conversation? Is it beforehand to set ground rules? Is it afterwards that we discuss it in the pub and go, what do we think's fair? Like, it's just so that we don't want to, because I know how important that sacred space of the studio is. Yeah. And you really don't want to pollute that with these types of conversations.
No, and I don't.
So when do you have them?
Yeah. I mean, I think if it needs to be brought up, I mean, I'm actually the only time I will really bring up anything about splits is if someone walks into the room with an idea, and then it's maybe me and that artist, and I'll actually say, look, just so you know, I don't consider this a 50-50. Like, you've got the lion's share of this because you brought it in. And then at which point I'll say, look, I just think anything created from scratch is equal from the ground up. But at the point where someone's brought something in, then that, and so to make them feel better, I guess, or to just establish that, yeah, if you brought a great idea in, that's a fully formed idea, then obviously, you know, I'll always come into the studio with ideas as any artist would, but, you know, like, okay, here's a chorus. What do you think of this chorus? You know, okay, we can work from that. But I don't like talking about business in the studio because I think, you know, again, going back to art and commerce, I think a lot of the commerce should be done maybe outside of the studio. And I think that, you know, it's important to be represented really well early on in your career. You know, I've always had a great lawyer. I've always had a great manager. And I think that when you're represented in that way, you don't worry. You know that you're going to be represented, and that, you know, you're working with the right people. Sometimes people are just trying to get a little extra. Again, I'll usually concede, but I would maybe think again about working with that person. Okay. Just because it's all about energy. And I think if the energy is greedy, it's weird. You know, you wouldn't. If you went out, going back to that analogy, you know, you go out for dinner with someone, they were like, I don't want to pay that, I didn't have a starter or whatever, you'd be like, not sure you'd necessarily want to go out again with that person. The same thing as writing a song. It's a very intimate kind of thing where it's all about giving. You know, I want people to come and enjoy the environment, enjoy the food, and, you know, I definitely give. I want to feel like I give more than I take, because I'm a giver. I'm hopefully a radiator, but, you know, I'm not like, you know, someone comes into the studio, it's like, it's their studio. They can help themselves to anything that they want in the studio. I'm not presenting them with a bill for the studio time, or a, you know, bill for the drinks or the having, or, do you know what I mean? It would be weird. It's about that sort of understanding.
The restaurant analogy is perfect. The problem is that those people do exist. That's still the problem, isn't it? Right? Yeah, so
it's all good. But, I mean, you know, people have those sort of insecurities about money. I'm more talking about
the credit. Like, is there anything, I mean, you probably can't answer this, but there might be, is there any time you see a song that perhaps you think a bit more than production on that, I could have liked, it would be nice to have a co-write or something like that, and how that sits with you? That must be difficult if that's happened to you.
I mean, I tend to be strong on that. I think you can, you know, things that I believe in, it's not about necessarily even the credit, but it's more about the sort of energetic sort of consequence of it, almost like the karma of it is right. And I think that you stand up for what you believe in, you know, and I think that things are right. But usually those conversations are what my manager would have with an artist manager or producer, another producer's manager or whatever. But I mean, usually those things are resolved pretty quickly. I mean, most people are good. I haven't had, you know, too many issues. And I think when they are, you're just like, okay, you can either find a way to creatively move around it or have a conversation. If people really still believe, then, you know, it's their prerogative to believe that their way of working is correct. But if you're a loggerheads, then it's clear that your values are very different, and I would never want to work creatively with someone or be friends with or whatever, be associated with someone whose values are very skewed to mine. I'm not saying mine are perfect, but they're based on sort of honesty and truth and integrity. So if you feel that that's being violated in some way, then you just move away. It's all good.
It's important to have this conversation, I think, because, you know, there will be a lot of musicians who go into the industry and they fear being exploited. So it's kind of reassuring to hear that they're, you know, that doesn't sound like it necessarily would be the case working with a producer and when it comes to splits and that kind of thing. And the fear of being exploited and giving too much away to achieve that kind of North Star, golden star that you want to get to, which is, you know, the level of success. So I think it's kind of an important thing to have had that conversation. That's great. We're now going to bring in our emerging artists. So regular listeners know that we often bring in an emerging artist, and we've got our own producer actually this time, which is Seb, who goes under the production name of Bastian Hughes, who's out in Melbourne at the moment at 5 o'clock in the morning or 6 o'clock in the morning now. So over to you, Bastian. What couple of questions have you got to Fraser?
Yeah, well, I just want to say firstly, like, thank you so much for this chat, and I don't know, I kind of had some questions and I've just been listening, and I've always been curious, like, how do you sort of both, like, stay grounded in yourself? Because obviously, like, yeah, you've had all these successes and different things, but, like, how do you sort of, you talk about, like, being authentic and commercial, and that's awesome when it lines up in the music sense, but how do you sort of be authentic and tactile, sort of networking throughout the industry, but also kind of, like, staying true to yourself or grounded or... You know,
good question.
Does that sort of make sense?
Yeah, completely. I think as a musician and a producer and a songwriter, you know, the thing is being an artist in that way is a very humble profession. You know, we start with nothing when we come into the studio in terms of, you know, a day in a creative day, you know, and we come up with great things. And I think that I never rest on my laurels. You know, I'm always learning. I'm always looking at other artists and seeing, you know, looking at and in awe of the greatness of other artists and other musicians, other producers. And that keeps you very grounded. I live a life which is fairly simple. You know, I have an amazing studio, yep, which is my dream here, but other than that, you know, we're not kind of, Sarah, my wife, and I are not the kind of people that are out every night kind of, as you said, like wanting to network, or, you know, I've always tended to let the music do the talking, and people can find out, you know, who worked on certain tracks, and then you attract the right kind of people. I'm not usually putting myself out there like in people's faces too much. And I think just enjoying that process of creation, and that just keeps you humble, because there's nothing more beautiful than coming up with a great song for me. And I think that then you produce it, and we're all, at the end of the day, like, moving into the unknown, you know. We're all sort of ploughing the field of creativity, sometimes things grow, and sometimes, you know, you plant some great seeds and for whatever reason those things don't grow, but you look at the experience and you just trying to enjoy the process day by day and not get too hung up.
Like, I'm sort of curious, because I feel like that, what would be a good example? Like, somebody like, would a Bowie or would, well, someone that you've worked with go like, I want to change the world, or, I mean, I don't know if I can insert myself, but like, I want to reinvent guitar and, I've been using like a weird hexaphonic pickup and like trying to make my guitar sound like a wavetable,
right. So,
but still be a, like a guitar. And sometimes I'm like, am I being cocky, or is that like fine? You know, like, do you see people being like that?
I think anything is fine, you know, in terms of you doing what you're wanting to do. I think similarly to you wanting to change the world with guitar, I think the sky's the limit. You can do what you want, you know. Don't think that you can't do that. I worked with one artist that just didn't have that confidence, and we made a great record together, and she just didn't have the belief in what she was doing. So I would say that it's actually imperative that any artist such as yourself and anyone else listening to this podcast just develops that self-belief. And it's not arrogance, because arrogance is not letting other people talk, or it's a huge amount of self-belief is important, and arrogance is a different thing.
Yeah, it's kind of like, do you experience a lot of, do you feel like with the great artists, and I don't know if it's some that you've worked with multiple times, maybe sometimes it's been successful and other times less records have been less, but, you know, just being totally obsessed, like, you know, are you seeing a lot of that sort of?
Yeah, I think you have to be.
Yeah.
You know, I've been totally obsessed for 40 years at doing what I'm doing, and I think that you can't be successful in anything without being totally obsessed. You know, and I think it's,
yeah,
whether it's researching about guitar pickups and wavetable synths through to a lyric, through to a compressor, through to a, I'm just totally obsessed by what I do. And I think the day that I lose that obsession will probably be the day where the music's not so good. And I would prefer to put a kind of full stop by music and then go and do something that I am obsessed about. But I'm just so lucky to wake up and go to sleep obsessed, and long may that continue, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And long may it continue for you. And long may it continue that you send me one of these incredible guitars that's a wavetable synth, because then we can, you both make history. I'll write some songs on it. Sounds very exciting.
Very cool. I loved sort of finding those restrictions to be creative within with those artists. And I suppose, do you have any tips on like, how do you create those boundaries? How do you sort of, do you know what I mean? Get like sort of the maximum out of those things, like psychology things. I don't know, like whatever comes off the top of your head.
The Brian Eno cards. I don't know if you've heard about those, but
Yeah.
That's a really good fun thing to do. You know, you talk about play, but you also talk about restrictions. I was in the studio recently with my friend Rob Milton, who's an incredible writer and producer, and Holly Humberstone, the artist. And I said, let's write this song based on the card that I'm going to pick out. So I picked out a card and it said, plan slowly, execute fully, execute quickly. So I said, okay, let's write this song without playing a single note on the keys. So let's talk about how we want to write it. Let's write the melodies in our head without playing the keys, and then when we're ready and we feel that we've got it, let's turn on every input channel onto Pro Tools and let's just record really, really quickly. So we tried it and we came out with a great song, and it was kind of torturous for us all, because we all wanted to kind of like, oh, how are the chords, but we forced ourselves to know what the chords would be and what the melodies would be, and we wrote the lyric. We all kind of separated out into different areas of the studio and just came up with stuff, and the song was put together in about 20 minutes.
I'm just curious, well, how long was that caving your heads process before you actually pressed record?
That was maybe a couple of hours.
Cool.
Yeah. So, and I think that deck of cards, the Brian Eno deck, is really good. Just pick one out. So there's a good sense of play, and that's maybe a good sense of boundaries. You know.
Thank you so much for your time. Thanks, Chris. I hope I've been too self-indulgent.
No, not at all.
The questions.
No, that's great. Thanks, Seb, and good luck with everything that you're doing.
And that brings us around quite nicely to the first thing we talked about was being on Brooklyn Bridge. I was there because I was with the 1975, and John Woff, who's a saxophone player, played on the Holly Humberstone record that you were just talking about.
There you go.
He's a sax player. There you go. So
all connected.
All comes around that the way. Listen, there's so much that we've taken from this. The last question I've got for you, you've given loads of advice to musicians through this podcast. What's the best bit of advice anyone has given you, Fraser?
So much advice over the years. Could I just spin that into someone asked me once what advice I would give my younger self.
Go for it.
I would just say, keep working hard, keep connected, keep breathing, and everything's going to be okay.
And that's the perfect place for us to wrap up. Thank you so much for your time, your wisdom, your advice. You've played on some of the most important performances, both in a live setting, and you've written some incredible pieces of music and produced, records that changed the world. And, you know, there's so much more left to come from you. So I just want to thank you on behalf of the listeners for your wisdom, advice, and it's been a pleasure. And thanks for being such a great guest on the Stage Left podcast.
Thanks so much, guys, and good luck to everyone out there. And that's fantastic, Chris. Thank you so much for all the great questions.